Real people. Real opinions. Real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.
Now, of course, the lockdown. Another 2 weeks. I mean, look, realistically, you know, you can talk about phase plans till they're hanging out of your yin-yang. But at the end of the day, nothing really happened on Friday. We're in more or less the same boat for another 2 weeks. It was a nice way of telling us, listen, we've got to do this for another 2 weeks till we see what's going on, because really we haven't the balls. And that's really what's going on at the moment. It's a kind of guessing game. It's a keep playing the game all the time and until we figure out what we should do or what the next step should be. And even the phases they've given us, they're movable. They're all movable. In other words, we don't know for sure if, for example, we get this, this and this and this, well, then we can move to this. So we don't really know yet. But the point is, that's creating a frustration in people. And people are finding it very difficult. Look, they've done the garden 400 times, they've built the wall, they've cleaned the house. They're finding it hard to motivate themselves. So I decided who better to get than somebody who's a motivational speaker and somebody who's been involved in mental health and mental health activist for most of his life. And that's Enda O'Doherty. Enda, good afternoon or good evening to you. How are you?
No, I'm fantastic, thanks be to God. I'm in great form. Super.
Good. Well, we're all in the lockdown for quite some period of time now, and probably for a period of time in the future, and we all need a little bit of motivation. You're the expert, and when I heard that you climbed Kilimanjaro with a washing machine on your back, I said, so you're having a laugh. And then I saw the photograph of you doing it, and I said, no, this man is for real. You are certainly motivated, Enda.
I don't know, motivated or mad, Niall. I don't know. So, you know, sometimes I hear, and I have often said this on radio or TV, I hear people sometimes doing the introduction and they're talking about this guy who's walked from Belfast to Waterford, done 9 marathons in 8 days with a washing machine, or like you said, climbed Kilimanjaro. And as I'm sitting back listening to the introduction, I'm thinking, that guy sounds a bit crazy, you know. And then the interview says, and Enda, how are you today? And then, it clicks, it comes back to reality, you know. So some of those experiences are, I know you've never done this, but if you've ever drank too much at a party, and you know the next day somebody says to you, do you know what you did last night, you know, when you were standing on the piano singing, or you did something outrageous. Yeah, naked, exactly. So sometimes when I'm talking to people about it, about my past experiences and the adventures, it's a bit like that. I'm almost like, you know, detached from it. I can't believe some of what's happened to me in the last few years happened, but
let's go back to the start, Enda, because you had, yeah, from what I believe, you had the good life. You had the nice house, you had the car, you had the wife, the job, you had everything going for you, but you had a drink problem. And what was it made, where was the turning point in all that for you? What was the problem with all that?
Yeah, well, the problem with that was, you know, I was drinking. I mean, when I tell people I was an alcoholic, sometimes, you know, in Ireland we have this perception that an alcoholic is going to be, you know, living in a wheelie bin under a bridge, you know, eating kebabs and out of the rubbish and having a dog called Freddy. And only the dog bit was true, but the rest of it
wasn't. Was his name Freddy, by the way?
Yeah, of course. But I was, like, if in a work scenario, you know, I'm assistant principal in a school, and if you saw me, I was first in, last out, suited, booted, happy, smiling. But I was drinking 3-4 bottles of whiskey a week.
And were you miserable? When you say you were suited, booted, happy, and you were doing your job and you were functioning very well, were you miserably unhappy?
I would describe it as dying in slow motion. What I was doing was extreme slow motion suicide. My Friday night, I'd sit down to watch the rugby and the old Celtic League. And I can remember clearly Friday night would be a pint glass of vodka. And I got to a point where a pint glass of vodka, I was merry, and I would probably drink some cough syrup as well. So that would kill most people, stop you
dead. What was the story with the cough syrup? A mate of mine used to do that years ago, and I didn't ever realize. I know that it's obviously a hit out of it.
I think it's just acts like a catalyst. It just magnified the alcohol. But I mean, right, it's lethal, dangerous. It could, you know, you could have a heart attack. You could die on the spot.
I know some alcoholics. We had an alcoholic on the show here going back about a year ago. And he told us at one stage he was so desperate, he had no money, and he would go into Beaumont Hospital and drink the hand sanitizer. And that's how desperate he became.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to you talk there about COVID and the payments, and, you know, in the show earlier. And, you know, it's a really weird thing, a really weird perspective. Everyone has their own view on life. But, like, I had to go to the pharmacy there this afternoon to get a prescription for my wife. And they insisted at the door I washed my hands with alcohol before I used my card. And And it's a really tough thing to be an alcoholic and to have to wash your hands repeatedly with alcohol.
With surgical spirits, yeah.
Oh, man, it melts my brain.
But you can smell it, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. But it's better than getting COVID, so I'm not that stupid, I'll do it. But,
right, okay.
From a work perspective, look, I was the guy, you know, I have a lovely wife, lovely kids, everything was good. But I didn't realize how many mental health issues I had until I stopped drinking, because I was medicating sleep disorder, depression, anxiety, panic attacks. I was burying those with my good friend, Mr. Hennessy and Mr. Smirnoff.
Okay, so you were just kind of masking the symptoms, so to speak.
Masking the symptoms, absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose for me, the crisis happened when I stopped drinking, because when I stopped drinking, all of these demons jumped up and started to scream at me that they demanded the attention because they had been suppressed for years, you know?
Yeah.
I think, too, it's a generational thing. I think my dad has decided not to drink, but if he had, and if he had gone the route I would, I think we would be fourth generation in a row where there was an alcoholic on the male side. Yep. So I probably didn't have the genes for it. He was cleverer than me. He said, nope, not going to take the risk.
And what was it like, without getting too personal, what was that like for your family to live with somebody like you?
The thing about, you know, like we're saying about different types of alcoholic, I had money. I had intelligence. I had the key word for me about being an alcoholic is deception and lies.
Okay.
I hid from everyone. Very few people knew what I drank. You know, I remember there was one particular work function I went to years ago, and everybody was drinking small bottles of Budweiser. So they had one or two each, which is not excessive at all. But you put those out on the table and it looked like there was 20 or so, you know.
Yeah.
I stood there with a pint glass of orange, which was filled to the brim with vodka. And I can remember my boss at the time saying to me, good man, Enda, somebody being sensible.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. Right. And you didn't disagree with him.
I didn't disagree, nor did I give him any sign that I had drank that much vodka.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a dishonesty there. But I suppose the mad thing with the washing machine came about because I promised myself when I got health sober that I would, which is now 12 years ago, I promised myself, like a lot of men, I'd buy an obscene amount of Lycra in my 40s. Lycra pajamas, Lycra teddy bear, Lycra pillows.
They call that the midlife crisis end of that.
my wife calls it part one because I've had multiple parts.
Did you not buy the red sports car to go with it? No.
No, I bought a white one, but it's about a white one. But I promised myself too that I wanted to help people that were in the dark spot I was in. I mean, I didn't attempt suicide, but I can remember a number of times walking and I'd see a juggernaut or a heavy truck coming towards me, and it made perfect sense to me to step off the footpath and get hit by that truck. Yeah. And
I've been in that situation not many times, once in my life in particular. I've been in that situation where you felt, so what's the point? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's for me it was logical, because the mad thing was the emotional pain and distress I was in, if you can imagine, that's bigger than getting hit by a truck. The truck was an easier option.
Yeah.
And thankfully, you know, something clicked in my head. You know, I have three wonderful kids. I have an amazing wife. I knew what it would do. And as a mental health campaigner and someone who's involved with fundraising and talking about suicide and self-harm, and like I've been to numerous suicide funerals, and you know, anybody who dies by suicide, it's just such an awful tragedy. But what I see on the ground is it just takes the pain and problem you have, it magnifies it and passes it to people you love.
Because those people you love are saying, why didn't they say something? Why didn't they tell me? And then there's so many questions to ask or answer after their death as to what put them in that place, or why they didn't get help, or why didn't they reach out and talk to somebody, or all that kind of stuff.
So I had done a couple of Ironman events where I swam 4K and, you know, the 180K on the bike and then run a marathon. And my wife said to me one day, are you going to do another Ironman event? And I said, no, I'm going to do something for charity. And she said, what are you going to do? And I love Irish women. And, you know, I think we have a great use of comedy in Ireland, because my wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to walk from Belfast to Waterford. And she said to me straight out, she said, is that all? And, of course, being an Irish man, I couldn't help myself. I said, well, I'll carry a washing machine on my back.
Which you did.
And she came straight back with, we'll go on. And I said, I will. And 6 months later, I walked out of the Europa Hotel with the washing machine on my back and about 15 people, and off we went. The washing machine, you know, going back to the suicide thing, the reason I carried a washing machine, obviously, it was to get media attention, to get the story.
Of course, and you did get it, because there's lots of pictures of you and, I don't know whether it's Zanussi or what it is, you and your good friend Whirlpool or Zanussi on your back, yeah.
Yeah, well, it was. It's funny. I tell people. People always ask me about the washing machine.
Did you take the weights out of it? Honestly, did you?
Oh, listen. I'm not as stupid as I look. Now, the first thing I did when I got home was I got the hammer and I beat it senseless. Took as many bits out as I could.
Because there's two big hunks of concrete in a washing machine, and I'm assuming you took those out because that wouldn't be humanly possible to carry that in your back.
Well, here's the thing: is you have a pen, I'm sure, on the studio desk there in front of you, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What weight would you say the pen is? 2 grams? Three grams?
I was going to say 2 grams. Yeah.
Right, so it's not a big weight.
No.
So if you hold that pen in your hand and extend your arm for the duration of this interview, I promise you in 5 minutes or 10 minutes' time, your shoulder will be crying, right? So what I said to people with the washing machine is a couple of things. First of all, it weighs about 40 kilos, so it's probably about the weight of an average 11-year-old. So if you can imagine an 11-year-old on your back from Belfast to Waterford, that's what
I know. So we've all done it as parents. If we've got kids and your kid wants to sit in your shoulders, you know, when they're two or 3 years of age and they want to sit in your shoulders and, you know, and it's just after a while, your back starts to ache. Yeah.
So it was that for 8 days. The reason I carried the washing machine was twofold. First of all, 8 people in Ireland on average lose their lives to suicide per week. And my message was a really simple one, particularly to young men and particularly to men listening to your show tonight. Don't carry a stupid load around with you. If you're carrying a load, a heavy, heavy problem, the best thing to do with that load is share it, ask for help, reach out, get some counselling, talk to someone, get rid of that load because it could save your life. And the second message was equally simple. It was that, you know, a lot of people came to me after all of this and they said, Enda, we're so sorry that we didn't come to you or help you or talk to you. And I said to them, you couldn't, because I was carrying it hidden. I would not tell people. So the second message we had was, you know, you have to ask people sometimes, are you okay? And you have to ask a second time or visit or ring, because many people are carrying a load that's invisible and you just can't see it. So that was the message behind the washing machine.
But is there a problem? And I'll get to Kilimanjaro in a second, because that's not where you stopped your stupidity. You went out to Kilimanjaro. We'll get to that in a minute. So, but in relation to men reaching out for help, it's no secret that there are less support systems for men than there are for women when it comes to mental health, or when it comes to, I suppose, domestic violence or bullying or whatever it is. There seems to be a lot of, you know, different NGOs out there which are funded for females, but we have very little, it seems, for men. Or am I mistaken?
I think things have improved dramatically in the last few years, and I think the conversation has changed.
Because, like, we're macho, you know what I mean? We don't get affected by stuff like that, I say sarcastically.
No. Well, I grew up in the 80s, and, you know, you didn't talk about things like this. You didn't admit weakness. And, like, what I've discovered in the journey I've been on and the people I've met is that real strength is the people who are able to say, I'm in trouble here, I'm struggling, this is tough for me, can you help me?
But isn't it hard? And it always was hard for men to talk about that, particularly when I mentioned domestic violence a second ago, right? We have a huge problem. Ireland, we don't have any figures. And I know Micheál Martin was asked by Gerry Adams some time ago, what were the figures for domestic violence against men in Ireland? And he said he didn't know. And I think Sinn Féin's Gerry Adams replied, the reason you don't know is because we never looked into it. We don't have the figures. But in the UK, they reckon 4 in 9 cases, but the majority of men don't report it. So is there still that thing for men? That, and you mentioned this, that, you know, it shows a weakness. Do men still think there's something weak about, you know, going to a psychologist or somebody professional or a friend and saying, listen, I have a problem in my life and it's really getting me down? Are we really bad at it?
I think we were atrocious, but I think as a country we have developed and changed and progressed, you know, that we're making real inroads. You know, like I grew up in a country where that, you know, if your sexuality wasn't, you know, the same as the majority, you had to hide it and you had to be ashamed and you were illegal. Or, you know, a country where we accepted terrible things happening in our society. I think, you know, society has opened and progressed, and I think people are more open to speaking about it. And that's why, you know, like, I'll be honest with you too now. Like, sometimes people say to me, like, I make my living as a speaker. I work with companies and businesses and sporting teams and inspire people with what I talk about. But I constantly stick with the pro bono stuff for the mental health charity stuff, because one of the things that I discovered in my journey for help was helping someone else is the biggest improvement or help to my life, you know.
Okay, because, like, you get a sense of satisfaction out of knowing that they're better.
No, I get a sense of satisfaction realizing that, you know, like, my dad's a great man, and he's cocooning for all he's worth at the moment.
Okay.
But he said, like, he would say great wisdom to me. He would say, like, remember that you know nothing, and remember it's your duty to help those around you. That's how you lift yourself up. And that's really why I got involved in it. But I think, you know, people have improved. You know, people are more aware that, you know, your life is valuable, and it's you've got to be responsible for your own destiny and save it. You've got to reach out and ask for help and talk.
Well, isn't it, I mean, somebody very valuable to me turned around and said to me that, and the very first thing that she said to me when I met her, and it was going back 3 years ago, was that the most important thing in your life is to value yourself. And I have to say, it's something that stayed with me for the last 3 years,
yeah.
Is to value yourself. Because if you don't value yourself, nobody else is going to put any value on you.
Yeah, well, I remember not so long ago, in the middle of one of our 9,000 COVID walks, I was talking to my wife and I said, why did you never tell me to drink less or to stop, you know, or why did you not tell me to, because if she asked me to do anything, we're together 30 years and I'd always do it, you know. And she's a very clever woman and she said to me, you have to save yourself first. She said, mm-hmm. You're responsible for you. If you stopped for me, she said, you'd have stopped for a week, a month or a year. But when you knew it was the right thing to stop for you, I knew there was no way you'd pick up a drink again.
Yeah.
And she was right.
Yeah.
You know, you have to save yourself.
I suppose that's what the Alcoholics Anonymous kind of theory is, that you have to recognise that you have a problem and you have to recognise that you're the one who wants to do something about it. Right, let's get to Kilimanjaro. So you weren't happy, you know, with your walk from Belfast. So you decided I'm going to climb Kilimanjaro, the second highest peak in the world, with a washing machine on my back.
Yeah, it was I suppose what happened was, after Belfast to Waterford, we raised so much money and it got so much public awareness and so many people were talking about it, and we managed to get Pieta House to open in Waterford, Waterford City, where I live. We set up a Facebook page, and if anyone wants to go back and look at old videos or adventures, it's called the Mental Health Challenge on Facebook. But we had enjoyed that and it was finished, and I remember, you know, I went for a walk one lovely summer's day with my wife, and we walked up Slieve na Mon, and we got halfway up Slieve na Mon, and I was just walking, and we're having a picnic, and one of my friends was with us, said, this would be a right spot for you to run up with the washing machine. And, of course, someone else said the worst thing you can say to me, Niall. Someone said you couldn't do it, and
oh,
that
stop.
Was it. I was away.
The macho kicked in, I can do it. Of course I'll do it.
So,
but now, like, there's a big difference in Slieve na Mon and Kilimanjaro, in fairness.
Well, you know, there isn't in a way, right? Because, you know,
in
and if there's any ladies listening to this tonight, what I suggest you say to your husband is, you'd never cut that lawn in 10 minutes. And watch your husband run out the door and try to be, because we're a challenge for a lot of men is great, you know, it gets us going, you know.
It was like the old thing when you were a kid and you wanted your mate to go to the shop for you. Go to the shop, or your brother. Go to the shop, go on, I'll time you. Go on, go.
Yeah, I'll and he had no watch on probably when he said
time
it.
Yeah. Right, so off you went to Kilimanjaro. By the way, on a more serious note, I know one of your colleagues died in Kilimanjaro, which it was very sad. Somebody was telling me earlier on.
Yeah. Well, the Slieve na Mon thing is, if anyone's climbed Slieve na Mon, the surface and the graduate slope in Slieve na Mon is pretty much what you get in Kilimanjaro. But the only difference with Kilimanjaro is it's like 7-8 days continuously up Slieve na Mon. You know, it's if you've climbed Carn Tuathail, day one you go from zero elevation to about 3 Carn Tuathails. You start off in the jungle. It's plus 20 degrees with 90% humidity. And when you get on summit night, it's minus 20, and you're talking, I don't know, 30 or 40% of oxygen that you have at sea level. So it's a shocker. Like, I have a photo, I sent it to one of your researchers there, that one morning I opened the tent door and I looked out, and I was 3 days walk above the clouds with the washing machine. And you were looking down on the clouds. I remember walking with someone, and one of my friends pointed down to the left, and he pointed downwards, and he said, look, what's that? And I sort of looked. I thought he was initially pointing at a rock, and he was pointing at an aeroplane. That We'd gone higher than the aeroplane. So the other thing was, one of the guides towards the end of the expedition, the guides were amazing. This guy, Emmanuel, was with me, and he got quite, serious on one of the final few days, and I said to Emmanuel, you're in bad form today, why have you changed your mood? And he said, well, we're at a height where helicopters can't fly anymore, the air is too thin, he said.
Oh, stop.
He said, if something happens, we have to carry you out.
I wouldn't be able for that, but I tell you why, and this comes down to motivation, and obviously you had the motivation to do this, because if I'm going to walk somewhere, right, I consider myself reasonably lazy, right, when it comes to walking, right? I'd rather take the car to the corner shop, okay? So if I'm going to walk somewhere, if I'm walking a decent distance, I'm always thinking to myself, the further I walk, the further I have to walk to get back again if I change my mind, right? So here you are, right, and you're up higher than helicopters can fly. I'd be looking out that thinking, if I want to give in now, I still have another 5 or 6 days to get back to where I want to go.
Yeah, yeah. You know what it was like the most challenging physical thing I've ever done. I mean, I knew this was going to be bad. I mean, very early on, I got altitude sickness on the second day. I had steroid injections and I was on oxygen on day two. Like I can bench press 90, 100 kilos for lots and lots and lots of reps. I'm a baby gorilla at the end of the training. I was really strong. I was in day two in Kilimanjaro and it took me an hour to eat a slice of toast because I couldn't lift it off the plate. That's what altitude sickness was like.
And how are your lungs, by the way? Were you ever a smoker?
I was never a smoker and, generally, but not always, but a lot of smokers will do well at altitude because they're already functioning on bad lung capacity.
Right, so they're used to it. Okay.
Yeah, I needed buckets of oxygen and about 900 calories a day and I couldn't do either. So I got really, really ill. I mean, on day two, I passed out and I managed to stand upright on the hiking poles so that the doctor didn't see me and pull the plug. And I managed to puke all over my feet and my wife's feet. She was standing beside me. But I remember I came around, Niall, and it was like a bad scene from a cartoon. There was a raven and a vulture sitting on a rock looking at me. And they were like, I could see the two of them going.
He's not going to make it.
We've got an Irish snack here, you know. One of the Africans who were amazing, the Tanzanians, walked past me and he said, Hakuna Matata.
And I've heard that line before, yeah.
Yeah, I was about to stand up and tell him where he could stick his Lion King. But thankfully I didn't, because I didn't realise that the Lion King, all the characters in it and all the language used in it is actual Swahili. It's African language.
Okay.
And when the guy said Hakuna Matata, what he was saying was, everything's going to be okay. You'll be okay.
Right.
You know, and the Africans were amazing. I mean, they'd heard about Ireland and they heard about the Irish, but like when they saw this Irish guy getting off a bus with a washing machine on his back, I'll never forget their face.
Typical Irish cab site.
No, they were just stunned.
But I mean, how are the Africans going up? These guys, it's like a walk in the park, probably. They're doing it on a regular basis for tourists and everything else. You know,
they were amazing people, getting paid very, very little money to do a hard job. One of the guides told me he had climbed Kilimanjaro 13, 14 times that year. And I said to him, why do you climb so often? And he said, because I love my family. It feeds my family. And they had a gentleness and a wisdom about them. I mean, I was walking along at one stage and I looked at my nails and they were like greeny, fungusy, horrible, black, you know, like really manky. And I looked at my nails and I said to one of the guides, Emmanuel, I said, God, look at my nails. I said, what the hell is that under my fingernails? And he took my hand and he had a look at the nails and he said, that's adventure.
That's adventure.
Yeah. So that's what they were like. I mean, I wanted to post stuff on Facebook, but of course the phone signal was so bad. But on the day we left for base camp in Kilimanjaro, I went into the Vodafone shop in Tanzania where we were, and I'll never forget it. I walked in and the Tanzanian Vodafone shop was staffed by Maasai warriors who were wearing the full Maasai skirt, painted faces, and had spears in the shop.
Right. Did you get a SIM card?
I did, yeah.
And did you not have to use a satellite phone in a place like that?
No, we listened. So I hadn't a clue. It was pure innocence. I mean,
imagine you don't get a phone signal. I mean, if you're getting as high as helicopters, you're probably not going to get a phone. I mean, the vultures would have been flying below you instead of above you.
There was a phone signal in places. I got so ill. Finally, on Summit night, we left and I was so ill at that stage that, you know, our message was share the load and ask for help. And it was the Irish people and the Tanzanians that got the washing machine the last hour and a half to the summit. And I had an oximeter on me, which is, you know, the little red light you put on your finger to see your oxygen level.
Of course,
The doctors, like, my oxygen level was reading 72 or 74, which in Ireland, I think if you're under 90, you're in an ambulance on the way to hospital. And I was a little bit away from losing consciousness. I didn't know, like, the doctor
said, wasn't that part of you saying at that stage, you know, I need to stop. I mean, I need to go back.
Yeah, there was, because
the logical part of you, I mean.
Yeah, well, the doctor was running mental tests on me to see, you know, how brain tests. So he said to me at one stage, he gave me an address. He said, like, 17 Brentwood Crescent, Earls Court. And he said, I'm going to ask you that in 5 minutes' time. You know, he was trying to test my brain function. But what he didn't know is for the next 5 minutes or 10 minutes, I just repeat the address constantly. So when he asked me, I just repeated what I had just heard.
Right.
And he thought I was okay. Now, I got steroids, I got oxygen. I knew the worrying thing for me now was at one stage he gestured to my wife and he said, you know who that is? And I had never seen her before. I had no clue who she was. And I knew at that point things weren't going well.
Yeah. Mind you, there's a lot of men listening at the moment be thinking to themselves, I'd like to be able to forget that.
Or who's done that on a Friday night.
Okay, so from that point, and I don't mean to rush you because you've had an interesting life already. You obviously decided you wanted to help other people. You became a motivational speaker as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the part I want to get to about motivation because the reason I want to talk to you tonight is because at the moment we're all finding it very difficult to motivate ourselves, particularly when we don't know when we can get back to some level of normality again. Although they keep talking about the new normal, I'm not happy to accept that. If you let me give you my personal circumstances, I'm very frustrated by this whole thing. I'm very frustrated by the fact I'd like to be able to go on holidays. I want my life back. I want the 2020 life that I had before. I want it back again. I want to get back to the normal. I want to be stuck in a car, you know, in traffic. I want all those things back again. And we're all so frustrated, you know, when we see Leo on the telly saying, oh, it's another 2 weeks, a bit more. And everything is like doom and gloom. And I understand people are dying. I'm not taking away from that, but it's all very grim. So how do we get through that?
Yeah, well, look, the first thing is, you know, think about what actions you're taking, you know, because if you sat down with your partner and you watch, let's say a very romantic movie, we won't say steamy, but let's say you watch a very romantic movie, right?
Okay.
It's no surprise that after that movie, either one of you or both of you are having certain thoughts about doing certain actions, right?
Okay. And what was the name of the movie, just so I can remember, write it down?
Any of them, multiple.
Yeah, right.
Right. But in the same way, you know, if you watch, I don't generally watch horror films, because if I watch a horror film and the bin, you know, the cat lands on the bin outside, I have a double heart attack because I start reliving the whole thing, right?
Right, okay.
And what I'm seeing now is a lot of people are watching constant death, destruction, fear, you know, like science reports. You're watching, feeding your brain all this, and then we're surprised that it elicits emotions in us, that like terror and fear and despair and all of those things. So first thing I've really done is when I get up in the morning, I watch the news. I need to know if there's any major improvements or something changing or something I need to do. But I don't feed that frenzy in my head all day. The other thing I would say to you is...
Well, see, unfortunately, I'm in a position where I can't help but feed
you
the frenzy.
You have no choice. Yeah, sure. You have, and it's surrounding you. But a lot of people do have the choice of reducing the amount of exposure they have to that. I think the other really important thing that I've learned is, you know, actions get you out of or get you into trouble. You need to do something, right? So I'll give you a practical example. So a negative thought, match it with a positive action. I was mentoring this lady, and I work with individual people from businesses and sporting people, but I was working with this lady. She's a very, very prominent business lady, and she was struggling with some weight loss. And she rang me one evening. She said, "Enda, I'm stopping this crack. I'm making no progress." I said, "Why?" She said, "It's just not working." She said, "I'm going to the gym 4 or 5 nights a week, and I'm getting nowhere." I said, "Where do you park your car?" She said, "What?" I said, "Where do you park the car?" And of course, she parked the car. She would have driven in the front door of the gym and gone up to the machine and parked beside it if she could. So I simply said to her, "Right, that's a negative thought. Let's take a positive action." The positive action was she parked her car about a mile and a half from the gym and walked there.
Right, okay.
Over six or seven weeks, she had done 2 marathons.
Okay, so you need to make it difficult for yourself as well in that particular situation, yeah.
Well, negative thought, take a positive action. So the first day I came home and with COVID broke out, I went to my laptop, I found a free course, and I did 7 week course in digital media marketing because I thought TikTok was a sound that came out of the clock in the kitchen. And now
I know otherwise,
right? Yeah. Okay, I knew, okay, and most people can see it coming, but most people don't take the action. I knew I was going to go to that fridge every 5 minutes and graze like it was Christmas Day. Right. Yeah. So what I promised myself that I was going to eat 3 large meals, eat healthy, but not snack in between.
Yeah, see, if I eat another bag of popcorn, you know, I mean, I swear to God. I mean, and that's all I'm doing. I'm eating cream crackers and popcorn.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? I'm just
because
I'm bored. I'm bored.
Yeah,
I think a lot of us are bored. So it's trying to, and then you say, well, I should be doing stuff to get rid of the boredom here. But you just can't motivate yourself to be bothered to get up off your arse and actually do it.
Yeah, but if you say to yourself, I'm bored, that's a negative thought, then you need to follow that with a positive action. Let's go and do something. You know, like if you think, God, I'm running out of money, you need to try and figure out a way to make more money. Like I continually am aware of what's coming, and I know my triggers for boredom. I know my triggers for depression and anxiety. So I will really, really work hard. And so like I'm still, a lot of my friends are staying up later and later, Netflix and binging drink.
So all our body clocks are doomed. Yeah.
We are about 20 minutes away from my bedtime. I will be asleep before 10:15. I had my breakfast at 6 a.m. Now, it's not that I'm Mr. Motivator, but I know for a fact if I keep my sleep...
By the way, can I mention for our regular listeners, Mr. Motivator will be ominous during the week at night.
That was not rehearsed.
Okay.
Yeah, but if I keep my sleep pattern regular, my exercise regular, if I keep my food, you know, in good shape, lots of good things then start to happen. You know, it's looking at your life as a whole web and realizing I've got to do lots of positive things that are going to help me. So like my plan at the start of this, there's a great friend of mine, he's probably listening this evening, and he works in the emergency response unit, and most of his weeks are filled with stress and pressure and, you know, firearms and crime, and, you know, it's a tough job he's in. But he said to me that when they finish after, you know, a significant event, something really difficult or scary happens, they sit down as a team, and what they look back and they ask themselves one question: did I survive or did I thrive? Like, what actions did I take that made my life better when this is over? Right? And for everybody listening to this, like, it's a different story for everyone. We all have different partners, different jobs, different areas, different locations, different dreams, different goals. But the one thing we do have in common is that we need to make a huge effort to take actions to do something so we come out of this in better shape than we went into it. And I agree with you. I don't want this new normality. I want to sit in a coffee shop, and if I want four coffees and read the paper for 2 hours, I want it. I'm so missing the bookies. I'm missing rugby.
I know, I'm missing just people shaking me hand. You know, I want to go back to people saying hiya and shaking your hand. You know, and we started off with people touching elbows. We're not even allowed to do that anymore. So I keep hearing stories then from Tony Houlihan and everybody else that, oh, next year when this is all over, there'll be no normal. This will be the way it'll be. The new normal will be social distancing. Hang on, that's not my new normal. What I'm saying is, at the moment, we're on a situation where we don't have a date, we don't have a target, we don't have a light at the end of the tunnel as such. We have kind of mishmash of a few phases from the Taoiseach.
Yeah, yeah,
but we don't really know. And there's this, it's the unknown. I mean, normally in my life, right, all the way through, I only explained this to somebody the other day, all the way through my life, I had targets. I said, right, I want to be a DJ. I want to work in nightclubs. I want to do 21st. Oh, I want to get my own business. And I've always thankfully achieved those things. And I've always been in that position. But I find myself at the moment in a position where I can't set targets, where I can't set a goal, because I don't see the future the way I used to be able to see it.
Well, I think you can set targets. And I will tell you, I think, you know, I often say to people, life is full of crap. Like, people will lie to you, people will steal from you, people will let you down, people will disappoint you, you know, illnesses will happen, people you love will leave, will die. Life is tough, we can't control all of that, but what we can control is our reaction to it. Have you ever heard, Niall, of Violet Jessop?
No, I can't say I have.
You love Violet Jessop. She was an Irish, her parents were Irish. She was born in Argentina back in 1887, and there was about 9 kids in her family. So as far as I can remember, the first 5 or 6 all died from different illnesses, but she survived. She got through, right?
Yeah.
She got tuberculosis, and the doctors told her mother that Violet was going to die, 100% say goodbye to your child. But Violet decided otherwise. She survived. She got through, right? She moved back to the UK after her dad died, and difficult time for her, but eventually she qualified as a nurse and she got a job on a ship called the Olympic, right? So if you can imagine this, she's got through all these hardships. She's sailing out of the harbour in Southampton, and the Olympic gets hit by an English battleship called the Hawk, and it sinks the ship on her first day.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
She survived. She got through it. She got a job on a ship called the Britannic, right? And you're going to say, I'm back on the sauce, I'm making this up. You can Google it. You can Google it when I'm finished.
It sank. But Helena, my producer, just said in my ear, she's Googling it as we speak, but go on.
No, tell Helena she's wrong. It got hit by a torpedo, and right? And as she's getting off the boat, she's in the lifeboat, she got hit by the propeller in the head.
Oh, stop.
Guess what, Niall? She got through, right? And so she had worked for this company loyally and got through all these tragedies. So they decided that, you know, she deserved a promotion. She got a nice job. She got a job as a nurse on a very famous ship called?
The Titanic.
There you go. And she survived. Right?
Nice.
She survived. And I read a story recently that she saved a child on the Titanic. She died in the UK in 1977 or 1978. And she got a phone call, I think allegedly, from the child who she saved on the Titanic years later to say, I'm the child that you saved. So I could tell you 20 people like that. And you said to me, you're finding it hard to be motivated. Like, it's our lot as humans to have difficulty. You know, but how we deal with the difficulty and the difficult times, it's up to us to make a positive decision. It's up to us to say, right, I'm going to do something. I'm going to get through this, you know.
And what about the idea? You talked about helping people, right?
Yeah.
And of course, it's hard to help somebody when you need help yourself sometimes.
Yeah.
But I've always had this thing, and maybe I'm wrong in saying it, that although there are other people out there who are miserable or depressed, right?
Yeah.
And it's my job to obviously look after me. And yeah. People often said, when you're miserable and depressed, you shouldn't surround yourself by negative people. You should distance yourself from negative people.
Yeah.
Is that the right thing to do?
Well, it's what works for you, Niall. It obviously works for me too. This is an awful question. Did you ever buy a pair of knickers that were a mistake? Did you ever buy a pair of boxers or underwear that they just didn't fit right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The luggage wasn't appropriately tucked on into the... And you spent the day either pulling them out or pulling them up or adjusting them, right? And I know, ask my lady friends this, and they all tell me the same, that they often, right? If you bought a pair of underwear and you put them on and they were cutting you to pieces, you would not tomorrow put them on and say, I'll give them another chance. The first night you got home, straight in the bin, you'd say, they were a disaster, I'll never buy that brand again, right? And I'm the same with negative people. Like, something that's toxic or negative to my happiness or my life, it's gone. I can walk away from someone mid-sentence if I think that they're a nutter or someone that's going to bring me down.
You said I was a nutter at the start of the show.
But it's true. Like, we need to make decisions. Like, there was a journalist interviewed me a couple of years ago, and he wasn't really nice. I knew he was he didn't really care about mental health, and he wasn't really interested in my story, and I knew he just wanted dirt, you know?
Yeah.
But he said to me, oh, what's your greatest achievement? And it was one of those rare occasions in life that, do you know, did you ever have a row with someone and 2 hours later you think of the thing you should have said? Do you know when you're at home and you say,
I should have told her
where to stick her microphone, or I should have told that bloody big person this. But sometimes in life the right thing just comes out. And your man said to me, he said, what's your greatest achievement in life, Enda? And I said, surrounding myself with brilliant people. Because the people, I only have people in my life that are funny, that are caring, that are helpful, that support me, that encourage me. And it took me years to realize that, you know, you get a short run at this. Like, I don't want to, I know we're probably coming to the end now, but I don't want to depress your neighbours, anyone listening, right? But the average Irish person gets 27,000 days of life, right?
Yeah.
So you got to be really careful.
It doesn't sound like a lot of days when you say it like that, does it?
It's very few. It's very few. Like, you and I are very lucky. I listen to the show and you clearly love what you do. You can hear the passion in your voice. Sometimes it comes out as anger. Sometimes it comes out as comedy. Sometimes it comes out as...
And sometimes I come out as a nutter. Yeah.
No, but you can clear the passion. But you see, the thing is, you need passion for what you do. Like, I love speaking. It's funny. Everyone assumes as a speaker that I'm really, like, super confident. I'll tell you, about 2 minutes before I go on stage, if someone came up to me and said, Enda, you can go home, I would run. I have double diarrhea, the shakes and the sweats. If you look at any publicity photographs, I'm always wearing a black or a navy suit. And that's because it's usually welded to me with sweat, with nervous perspiration.
Yeah, but see, I'm the same. I mean, I'll chat away on radio to my heart's content. There's nobody else in here can see me anyway, apart from the producer. But, you know, we have listener parties and stuff, and I'm so uncomfortable with the whole idea of people coming over for selfies and all that kind of thing. I'm very uncomfortable in social gatherings. I don't go into pubs because I don't drink. And I don't like going to places where there's lots of people. You know, so I'm not very confident in those situations, but I am confident behind a microphone or even on television or whatever it happens to be. And I've done a bit of television as well. But I don't mind doing that. I just forget that people are listening.
Yeah, I know 30 seconds into what I'm doing, I could not be any happier than when I'm performing or speaking in front of people. I really love it. It's just pure heaven to me. But, you know, my point about, you know, can you get through adversity? Can you keep going? And the other thing to you is, you know, like, realizing that you've got to fill your life with good people, good experiences, you know, to do as much as you can, because, like, you just don't know. I mean, like, I love reading about all these people who, like, a lot of people say to me, Enda, you've gone through a lot of difficult times. You're an inspiration. But I take inspiration from other people. You know, I love to read these stories and find out about what other people have got through. I came across, have you heard of this guy, Nigel Ogden? Have you heard of him? No?
No, I haven't, but you're going to tell me.
I can tell you now because nobody's going to be flying for a few months and you'll have forgotten before you get on the plane again. But there was a flight, 5390, with a BA flight. I think it's about 16, 17 years ago, flying out of London. And they were half an hour outside London on the way to Malaga in Spain, and the windshield on the cockpit blew out completely.
Okay.
And if you can imagine this, the pilot was sucked straight out the window, and this guy, Nigel Ogden, managed to grab his pilot by his two feet and hold on to him.
Oh, my.
Now, at 17,000 feet, right, at 17,000 feet, now, they're doing about 340 miles an hour, and it's about minus 20 degrees.
And he's hanging out the window. Yeah.
He is plastered, you know, like a shirt across the top of the plane. Okay. And Nigel held him in place for 22 minutes till they got back to Southampton, landed. They both had frostbite and they both survived. Now, I know it's an extreme case, but I always go back to what I say to people is, like, when you're going through hell, if your life is muck and you're just suffering, like, and you're thinking, like you just said, when will this end and I want my old life back? All you have to do is just keep going, keep moving forward. It will pass. Like, people said to me sometimes, you know, Enda, when you're walking from Belfast to Waterford, I hope people aren't eating any snacks listening to this, but I lost all of my toenails.
I know people. I've never done that kind of stuff, by the way. But I've talked to people. And when I was younger, actually, I did run a marathon. But what I know, but they lose nipples and all sorts of things. And
lost all of my toenails. I lost the fat pads from the front of my feet. I had hallucinations. The main road turned into a snake. I had what can only be described as Chernobyl diarrhea. It was radioactive and glowed in the dark. I was as sick as hell, and then it got really hard because I broke my two feet because I was carrying this washing machine. Because I weigh 100 kilos.
So what kept you going? The adrenaline kept you going.
Well, here's the thing is...
And the motivation, I suppose. Yeah, you wanted to finish, you had to complete it.
All I did was take one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I did. I did not walk from Belfast to Waterford. I literally walked from one foot to the next foot. Like, I remember each night in the hotel, we'd get back to different hotels, and the crew were with me, with the gang was great, and the crack was mighty. They were slugging the pints and drinking the chips, and they were saying, did you remember this house, and do you remember that lovely girl we met, or what did you think of that politician? And I had no memory of any of it, because I picked a spot on the road, I put my head down, and I just focused on front of me, and just kept moving forward. You know,
and that's what I'm sorry to come back to what I said to you a few minutes ago. This is what I've done with my life. I've picked a spot every single time. I've picked a spot and said, I will be doing this by this time. I will have this by this time, or, you know, this job by this time. But that's what I think a lot of people like me at the moment are finding themselves in a situation where your timeline has completely been disrupted by the fact that, you know, there's nothing happening, no planes flying, no cars on the road, you know, there's no targets. Everybody's job is in jeopardy, including radio, by the way. Everything is in jeopardy at the moment. We don't know where we all stand. So all that has been just turned completely upside down for people.
Yeah, and it's a time to slow down a little bit. About 2 years ago, I saw this guy on Facebook, Eamon Keaveney is his name. He got into the Guinness Book of Records. He walked the entire circumference of Ireland barefoot. And when I saw this guy, and he was doing it for Pieta House, when I saw this guy on Facebook, I said, I'm going to reach out. And I messaged him and I said, look, I told him about my washing machine. I said, I'd love to come and help you and just spend a day walking with you. And we walked together. But of the whole day, I remember one conversation. His feet were immaculate. He had no cuts, no scrapes, nothing. And as we walked along, we came to a really, really dangerous, rough piece of tarmac with rocks sticking up. And I said to him, God, Eamon, this must really hurt you. And he said, no, he said, what you do, he said, is when you come to a really bad patch, you just slow down, you take your time, you navigate through it, and when I get to the smooth tarmac or I get to the grass, then I walk on again. And it stuck with me, and it's so powerful. Like right now, we're on the rough tarmac. Right now, we're walking along, and we're going, oh my God, will this ever end? But, you know, we just have to persevere, and the smooth stuff is on the other side. We will see it, and we will get through.
It's been wonderful talking to you, Enda. Absolutely wonderful talking to you.
Thank you so much. My wish for you is when you're sitting down with a glass of a nice cup of coffee or
Red Bull,
and you have your feet up on the couch, and you're reeling in the ears comes on, and they talk about 2020, and you look back and go, Jesus, that was mad, wasn't it? I wonder whatever happened to that nutter with the washing machine end over.
And you would ever say, I wonder whatever happened to that nutter on the radio station. Listen, Enda O'Doherty has been wonderful. If you want more information on Enda, you can go to his website, endaodoherty.ie. He does all this kind of motivational speaking, also helps with mental health. He's an activist as well. Enda, it's been wonderful talking to you. It's actually inspiring talking to you. Thanks very much indeed, and I appreciate you coming.
God bless.
Real people, real opinions, real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.